Hello and welcome to Animal Companions. This is Joyce Vesper, your Sun Sounds of Arizona Radio Reading Service volunteer broadcaster. Today I'll be reading another chapter from my beloved monster, Masha the Half-Wild Rescue Cat, Who Rescued Me, by Caleb Carr, and if we have some time, I'll be reading some articles and newsletters from books about the animals in our lives. We're going to start today's readings with My Beloved Monster by Caleb Carr. In the last chapter, we learned that Masha, the watch cat, alerted Caleb to a nefarious man who tried to break into Caleb's home. But Caleb was able to reach the troopers in time, and they took the man into custody because he was known to the sheriff before. And now we start Chapter 18, Pacts. As the weeks of writing in the upstairs study went on, sudden inexplicable attacks of fierce pain in the chest and gut began inside of me. When they struck, I'd retreat with Masha close beside me, to usual suffering spots on the Chinese rug in our bedroom. Masha took up her now accustomed post next to my head and watching me with her most worried expression. I tried hard not to frighten her. When I got relief from the pain for a few minutes or more, I would reach over to stroke her cheeks and neck and tell her that this was nothing and that it was just going to pass, and that she had seen it all before. She hadn't, and she knew it, and that I'd be okay and would never abandon her, which apparently remained a primary question in her mind. Behind the worried brow and the dilated pupils in the huge eyes, there was a sort of warning, the first message from her that I thought I could read as exactly as if she were stating it. No, you don't. You're not leaving me here with your dog-loving family and your weird friends. No, you don't, mister. You're not dying on me. I reassured her as often as I could that no, I was not dying, though there were moments when I felt otherwise. And to further ease her mind, I suggested a new pact, one that would eventually become the great rule of our life together. I won't die if you won't. Each of us, I told her, had to vow not to go before the other, leaving nothing to worry about. Of course, I can't prove that she completely understood this agreement, but both of our lives, which were already informed by similar understandings, from then on became demonstrably ruled by this latest and most explicit of them. After the unexplained attacks had struck several times, I decided to seek a specialist's counsel. Luckily, my doctor in New York also happened to be an excellent gastroenterologist, so off I went to the city for consultation, the problem being that when I saw him, no attack was underway. This led him to suggest that the new symptoms might be elaborations of those long-standing ones caused by the adhesions. To be safe, we needed a new abdominal scar and got one. But adhesions don't generally show up on such imaging, and the scan was clear, which meant all that was available for the moment in terms of treatment was medication that I was already taking. I was tiring, discouraging day. It was in the city, and it might have been wise to stay the night at a friend or at a hotel. But I remembered another pledge I'd made to Masha, that she would never have to worry about me being gone for too long. Indeed, I realized that we had never spent even a single night apart. So I shoveled myself back into my truck and headed north through the early spring evening at a fast clip. My characteristically lead foot got me home in well under the usual 3 to 3.5 hours, fast enough to find my companion still sitting in the sill of her northern escape window and looking very worried. She stood and started to softly cry as soon as she saw the truck pull up to the house. And when I got out and hobbled up to the window to scrape my hand against the nylon screen, she leaned her weight into it with happy relief, offering her nose to mine through the soft mesh. Once inside the house, I lay down on a rug as Masha did delighted little steps around my head, purring loudly and eventually lowering her own cranium and butting her forehead into my face and neck, grinding it home like a good Siberian. Then we went for a ramble around the porch, which she'd earned, but we soon returned so that she could allow herself the kind of feast she seemed to have put off that day. And she happily ate fresh food, I realized that I had, through her achieved the kind of thing every author desires. My latest book might have been fiction, but the emotional heart of the story was absolutely and increasingly true. This was to be the pattern of things for a long while, throughout the researching and early drafting of the new story. I had another couple of attacks of this mysterious illness, but each eased up after a couple of days and then passed. Even Masha got a bit more used to them, although she never left me when they were happening, except to eat and do shortened versions of her patrols outside once the weather really warmed up. Most sick days, and always through the nights, she was there beside me on the floor, or if I needed a change of venue, on the ottoman in the front of the room, on another love seat, this one in the basement bedroom. In that lower chamber, perhaps, thinking that my temporary relocation there meant something dire, she did especially endearing things, like she placed her paw atop my arm if I groaned or writhed too tellingly, and occasionally she twisted her head so it was upside down as she lay on the ottoman, in an effort to amuse and distract me. I wasn't kidding myself. However, these attacks were clearly leading to a more serious crisis, and after a mental search to determine what factors in my life might have been triggering them, I came up with one: stress, that chief feature of a writer's life, which had hit hardest just when I reached the halfway point of the book's first draft. The head of my publishing house, unhappy with the tardiness of the last book in their hugely profitable fantasy series, flew into a fit of temper and sent out word to all the house's fantasy authors that there were to be no more fantasy series, period. Those of us affected were to finish up what we were working on and turn in just one volume. I quickly protested, and that I was writing fantasy, but a fact-based allegory, and that I'd structured the first book to be just that, an initial installment, which I'd now half completed. "No matter," said the chief, "wherever you are, the larger story was going to be, I'd have to jam it into one volume and call it done." Much of the work that I'd already finished would therefore have to be restructured as to mean nearly a complete rewrite, and then somehow I would have to create an abbreviated version of the rest of the story. There was nothing else to do. We were growing low on resources, Masha and until I turned into manuscript form, no funds would be forthcoming. The project had suddenly changed from a dream to a minefield, yet I had to try to stay focused and find a way through it. Masha's presence continued to guide me and make the process bearable, but even with her keeping close tabs on me after only a couple of months, I began experiencing the absolute worst attack yet of the mystery ailment. I'd long since learned that there are levels of pain you can endure. Then there is an extra gear that pain can shift into that lets you know you're in serious, even mortal trouble, and that was happening once again. But an additional and much more vital consideration had now to be factored into any thought of hospitalization. That was Masha. The August night when the crisis struck was truly wretched. Adding to the stress of not knowing how we were going to survive was an even greater weight of trying to explain to Masha that I might have to leave and that she would have to take care of the house, a phrase she was already coming to know. And she would have to be especially brave. If I did go, I'd likely wouldn't be back until after one night time, and maybe more. I just didn't know. But I would be back, I promised. I was still mindful of our principal promise to each other, and there was nothing that was going to make me forget it. These little talks were designed to soothe my own nerves, plainly along with Masha's, in the hope that by talking it out, I could make myself feel better about practical matters, and therefore less physically stressed. It didn't work. By 8 the next morning, I found myself repeating all my instructions and pledges to Masha as I waited for my older brother to arrive with his car and ferry my agonized self to the hospital where my local doctor was on staff. Unfortunately, I was heading to the emergency room on Friday, known everywhere as the worst time to go for an emergency surgery. The best of any hospital staff, especially in the summer, are on their way out for the weekend or longer. After several hours waiting, I was in pitiable shape, the pain in my chest and insides as always aggravating the pain of my neuropathy. It was a connection about which I had my own suspicions, rooted in the spinal guru's warnings years earlier that touched on the childhood injuries to several discrete spots in my back, warnings that came ringing back as I half sat on a gurney trying to suffer silently. "Were you," the guru had said uncomfortably after examining both the MRI and me, I'd brought him, "in a bad car accident as a child?" Strange question, I thought. No, miraculously enough, given the condition of the adults who were doing the driving, we never had an accident. The guru sighed without looking over at me. Then the next question I have to ask is more, delicate. Were you, he didn't seem to know how to go on. Oh, I said, realizing his point. You're talking about violence? He allowed himself to breathe more freely and nodded gratefully. Thank you. It's never easy to ask. It's all right, I told him. And the answer is yes, at which I explained the whole story to him. But why do you want to know? You see, he answered, the exact pattern of your spinal injuries is something we only see in two sets of cases, bad car accidents in childhood or abusive trauma during the same stage. There it had been, and here I was, awaiting another apparently inexplicable emergency room surgery. Eventually, I was prepped and rolled into the readying room to meet the man who would perform the exploratory. An amiable old fellow who, as a friend later put it, had probably been a capable surgeon 30 years ago. But now? When I came out of the anesthetic, I only had to view the job that had been done on me, sliced open from sternum to beneath the navel. I had been closed by stitching that was plainly going to leave a more Frankensteinian scar than ever those I had already in that area. The pain in my chest might have gone away for now, along with my apparently inflamed gallbladder, but there was no sense that anything truly helpful had done any better. 4 nights and 3 days passed in an awful routine, fighting to get a handle on the ambulatory recovery and worrying constantly about Masha. I queried those relatives who visited me about her and was told that she was fine, or at least they thought she was fine. She was hiding and wouldn't come when called, but her food disappeared when laid out, which was all deeply troubling. Masha was often careful about being social, but disappearing was something she would have done only if severely stressed. So what was stressing her? I began to get the answers. Apparently several family members had decided to oversee the thorough cleaning of the house as a surprise for when I got home. Having strangers banging about the place, shouting to one another, running vacuums and washers and dryers, and then leaving Masha alone through each night would have badly confused and even unnerved her. If I'd been able to explain it, she would have been okay. But as it was... From the moment of learning about all this activity, I started clamoring to be released from the hospital. They had to let me go. Eventually, though it soon became clear that none of the surgeons was any more sanguine than the one I had that was underlying the problem had been solved, and an all-too-familiar experience for me. However, I was finally allowed to leave on the 4th morning by overstating how well I felt. The trip home turned out to be a physical ordeal, revealing certainly that the incision in my torso had really been a hatchet job. That hatchet job had a great deal to do with the course of my homecoming. My brother helped me get settled on the great room couch in front of the big television, and I started at once to feebly call to Masha, who did not appear. I asked my brother if he was sure she hadn't gotten out, in which case I was certain I would never see her again. But he said no, that she'd continued eating and everyone had been careful not to leave any doors open. After I lyingly assured him that I was fine being on my own, he left, while I kept calling to Masha, until it grew dark. Only then did she answer. And it was a truly startling answer. In a voice I would never have been able to identify as hers, she began to yowl, finally coming downstairs from the upper study, which had remained her refuge by being the one room the cleaning crew had not entered. But she did not seem at all relieved by the fact that I was home. Indeed, though she came to the couch once or twice to be petted, she never really looked at me. She kept screaming in that terrible way and moving quickly to each door and window in succession. It was plain what was happening. For 4 days and nights she had been unable to fulfill her daily ritual of at least stepping onto the porch and thereby assuring herself that she could get outside, if she had to. And the confinement had driven her half mad, yet I couldn't allow her to go. I could barely reach the door myself, and while I hoped medication might give me the strength to go out onto the porch with her, it scarcely made sitting on the couch bearable. When I finally got Masha to jump up beside me, I held her shoulders and got her to look me in the face. But she only seemed to vaguely know, or rather to care, who I was, and she never stopped that very uncharacteristic and frightening yowling. What had happened? Had the effects of my hospitalization been so terrible that not only what I'd thought to have been our secure bond, but Masha's very ability to recognize me as well had been destroyed? Was such a thing even possible? I told myself that it wasn't that never in my history with cats had I lost a cat's basic attachment due to an arbitrary absence or to a lapse in judgment. But was that really true? Or hadn't there been one cat long ago with whom my bond had never been quite secure? Indeed, there had been one, and I began to realize and remember lying there on the couch in furious discomfort and listening to Masha's yowl. And if my experience with that cat were being now repeated, then I was in for a very heartbreaking experience with my Siberian in the days to come. We'll learn whether or not that experience occurs in our next chapter, titled Echoes, in the book My Beloved Monster, Masha the Half-Wild Rescue Cat Who Rescued Me, by Caleb Carr. Our next reading comes from Michael Lindnord's book, Rescue Dog Tales, and this is a story about Dewey, his owner, name Emmeline, and he came from the Humane Society in Canada and the SPCA Montreal, Canada. He now lives in Montreal, Canada. I've fostered and adopted a few dogs in my time, but Dewey always stands out for me. Sadly, he died last year after a rough start in life. We got to have a few great years together, and I can't think of a better dog to be a champion for rescue dogs. I've lived in Montreal for 10 years and have been very involved with animal rights during that time, which is how I ended up being a volunteer at the SPCA of Canada during a pupple mill seizure that was undertaken by HS International and the SPCA. All the rescued dogs from the mill had been brought to the SPCA shelter, and I was helping to look after them. The dogs were mostly Yorkies, with about 10 Chihuahuas, and something about the cheerful, funny, sweet, but mischievous nature of the Chihuahuas really appealed to me. Knowing what they'd been through, as I did it, seemed amazing to me that they could play so happily in their pens, although it did take them a while to trust new people, especially men. For the dogs to remain in healthy condition, physically and psychologically, it was important that they got placed in proper foster homes after being evaluated. Volunteers like me were a first choice, and I'd made several choices regarding the dogs with whom I'd connected to the most. I felt like I'd bonded with most of the 3 Chihuahuas and 1 Yorkshire Terrier, but ultimately it was up to the employee in charge of the placement who she thought would be most in need of a foster home. This is where things took on an unexpected turn. Dewey wasn't in the section I volunteered in. He'd been a stud in a puppy mill and had been brought into the vet because he had health problems due to the poor treatment at the mill. He had severe dental issues and had to have all of his teeth removed. The employee in charge of placement sent me a picture of him when he'd first been brought in, and my heart just melted. The next time I was at the shelter, I decided to make a pass by the vet to have a look at him, and I just knew. He was the sweetest dog ever. Even now, it makes me cry to remember that moment. When I first fostered Dewey, and brought him home, my biggest concern was how he'd react to my 2 rescue cats. But I shouldn't have worried. The cats were more curious than he was. He immediately made himself comfy in the bed I'd prepared for him in a big drawer and stuck his head out to look for me every time he wanted something. He'd been described as very shy on the shelter assessment scale, and he was, but I soon discovered he was very sweet, too. The shyness was the biggest hangover from his difficult past, and he used to tremble when exposed to new situations or environments. He always stuck very close to me when he felt protected, and he didn't trust other people easily, though I have to say I have a lot of trust in dogs' intuition. It soon became clear to me that as much as I loved fostering Dewey, I really wanted to adopt him. This wasn't plain sailing, however. I know this might seem unbelievable, given the circumstances, but legally the puppy mill owner still owned all the dogs, and the SPCA were locked in a legal battle with them to give up the dogs so they could be adopted. Finally, in mid-December 2013, the puppy mill released the dogs, and foster families were given priority. I knew by then that I couldn't live without Dewey, so when I heard I could proceed to adoption, I cried tears of joy, and when I got home, I hugged him close. People might have not expected it of a Chihuahua, but Dewey loved the great outdoors and running around. He also got to live in two different countries, and he enjoyed his stay in both of them, Canada, where he was born, and Ecuador, where I was born. He was such a strong personality and had no fear of other dogs, even though he was so tiny and looked so vulnerable. He could happily stand next to a Great Dane and make friends. He also loved hiding himself completely under the sheets on a bed, and grabbing sheets and towels and clothes and building little caves for himself, seemingly not even leaving a gap for breathing. If I came and removed a towel when he'd buried himself and left any part of him exposed, he would not be too happy, so I always put them back. I remember every time I got in from work, he would be standing at the door, and as soon as I came in, he would run to sneak himself onto the bed and wait for me to come and give him attention. It was a game for him. He fitted perfectly in my purse and came everywhere with me, the supermarket, the shopping center, and even the cinema and the theater. He was so adaptable and happy as long as we were together. Every dog I've ever had made my life better, but Dewey is the one who really changed my life. He woke up my maternal instinct. I wanted to protect him and for him to enjoy every minute of life and be confident in every environment. He taught me the importance of caring about the ones we love, no matter how hard life is, and he taught me how to be strong. Even though he was so little, he was strong. He endured so much, and yet he was so sweet, so loving, and got so much out of life. Because of Dewey, I became an even more vocal activist about puppy mill problems in Canada, and because of him, I hope I can make a difference. Sadly, Dewey was diagnosed with brain cancer in early 2016 and died 4 months later. I was heartbroken, but he taught me another lesson there. The life should be lived with quality, and that we have to be wise enough and brave enough to know when we have to say goodbye. He gave me so many wonderful memories, and he was such a wonderful companion. I couldn't have asked for a better dog. And to anyone thinking of getting a dog, I would say, please, get a rescue dog. It's a huge commitment, but the love you get in return is pure, unconditional, and completely unforgettable. This story about Dewey appeared in Michael Lindnord's book, Rescue Dog Tales. Our next article was reviewed by Vanessa Farmer, Doctor of Veterinary Medicine, and it is titled Howling in Dogs. Howling is your dog's way of communicating with you in the world. The howl is to get attention, make contact with other dogs, and announce their presence. Howling is instinctual and can be natural or triggered by an underlying problem. Some dogs respond to high-pitched sounds like emergency sirens or musical instruments by howling. Excessive howling can be a sign that your dog is in trouble. Problems to rule out first. There could be a variety of reasons that your dog is howling. Howling can be a symptom of separation anxiety. Your dog may complain of excessive howling while you're away or at work. If your dog is left alone or away from another owner, they may also pace constantly, have destructive behavior, soil the house, or have depression. Acting out because of separation anxiety should not be punished harshly. Instead, identify the problem and make arrangements for your dog to feel safe and secure in home. If your dog has separation anxiety, they are constantly in distress while they are alone. This could be triggered by one person leaving them or spending too much time outside away from the family. There may be a medical reason behind your dog's howl. If your dog suddenly starts howling frequently, they may be telling you that they're hurt or sick. Look for signs or causes of your dog's distress. If you can't find anything, you should schedule a visit to the vet to rule out illness or injury. What to do about excessive howling? Howling in response to sounds. If your dog howls when they hear a high-pitched sound from an emergency vehicle, they are telling everyone that they hear the sound and are ready to respond. It's their instinctual way to say that they're aware of their surroundings. Desensitization and counter-conditioning. If the howling is based on how your dog feels about a situation, you'll need to change their motivation and feelings. This isn't easy to do, but can be accomplished through consistency and perseverance. Desensitization and counter-conditioning are common treatments for fear, anxiety, phobia, and aggression. The goal is to get your dog to change its mind or feelings about a certain trigger. If you are having trouble with the treatment, a licensed certified animal behaviorist, known as a CAAB, or a veterinary behaviorist, known as an ACVB, boarded, can assist you. This article, reviewed by Vanessa Farmer, Doctor of Veterinary Medicine, is titled Howling in Dogs. We're now at the completion of Animal Companions for today. I do hope you've enjoyed the reading, and I invite you back again next time to hear more stories about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Until then, this is Joyce Vesper for Animal Companions and for Sun Sounds of Arizona, a radio reading service. Be well, everyone. Stay healthy. Be happy. Bye-bye.